And welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today is another one-on-one interview special with Tracy Edwards. Now, back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, Tracy found herself working aboard ships as a cook. She's British. And that was a good life for a while. And then she heard about sailing trips, competitions around the world on, you know, on these big sailboats from one of her male friends. And at first, she wanted to go aboard, but no team wanted to be that team where they had a woman aboard. So what did she do? She formed her own sailing team of all women. And this was in the 1989 Whitbread Tournament. Whitbread was the sponsor at the time. They didn't win the competition, but they did win a couple of individual legs, even in the face and in spite of the mounting sexism that they faced. Nowadays, Tracy is a public speaker and an activist for girls' education, but she is still connected to the sailing world remotely. A few years back, her ship, the Maiden, as it was called back in the 80s, was sort of found in a decrepit state, and they got the money together and refurbished it. And Tracy and her team are the subject of a new documentary entitled Maiden, which talks about her and that fateful tournament back in 1989. This interview did hold some personal significance for me. My late uncle, Roger, was a man of the sea. He was a lighthouse keeper. He lived on a boat for many, many years and sailed into the Philippines, where he met his wife, and where my cousin, his daughter, was born. So we get into all that with Tracy about just what life was like on a ship running a sailing team, and the time she did dishes next to the King of Jordan. This is my interview with Tracy Edwards. Tracy Edwards, hello, good morning, how are you today?
Very good, how are you?
Doing well. We got a bit of a snowstorm here, but we're surviving.
Excellent.
So you are the subject of a new documentary called Maiden. But take us back to the beginning. I know you started working on ships as a cook when you were in your 20s, but what would you say first attracted you to that lifestyle?
I think for me it was a way of escaping my home life, which had become intolerable. And not that I made it any easier, I have to say. but I needed to escape, and so I pretty much sort of ran away and went off backpacking around Europe and literally fell into sailing. I was working in a bar, guy came in one night, I was 17 years old, I had no money, no prospects, no exams, no qualifications, and he just said, you know, how do you feel about stewardessing on a luxury charter yacht? So I went, okay, and ended up on this amazing, it's beautiful yacht, but of course the lowliest of the low being the stewardess. And within 4 days I realized, oh my goodness, I found the thing I should be doing, which was the luckiest thing in the whole world. And then I just worked my way up through the ranks.
You know, whenever we hear in the media about, you know, cruise ships, and I have some friends who are, you know, entertainers on cruise ships, they definitely talk about the lifestyle in a very particular way. How accurate is that description in terms of how that lifestyle is covered in the public discourse?
I would say, I mean, obviously we were tiny compared to, you know, sort of a large cruise ship. So we would have 7 crew and 12 guests on these. The first yacht I was on was 120-foot beautiful Edwardian motor yacht with varnish and brass, and I mean, it was just beautiful. But I would say probably the same kind of people get attracted to this lifestyle. And I think for me, what I loved about it was the fact that we seemed like a bunch of misfits, you know, that we were nomads, if you like, and we kind of all sort of fallen into this life. And we were all there for different reasons, but I would say that most of us were there to not be somewhere else. And I think that was something that really struck a chord with me. And I think as well that for the whole of my life, I'd felt as if I was on the outside looking in. I never really got stuff. And as soon as I was sailing with these crazy people, I got it. And they got me. And that was what was so amazing. It was the people.
Yeah. And then, of course, after that, you decide to, you want to enter this big trip around the world. And I know you were initially turned down, but what made you decide this was the next step in your life that you wanted to take?
Well, I started doing a bit of racing, and I thought, wow, this is so much more fun than cleaning toilets and walking up. I was treated pretty much as an equal on these racing yachts. It was small time, you know, sort of small yachts and not big races. But one of the guys that I was racing with, he'd done the Whitbread Around the World race, and I saw him in a book, and I said, oh, wow, this looks amazing. What is this? He said, oh, this is just so much fun, racing around the world, all these different types of yachts and people. And he said, for 9 months, it's just this amazing adventure. He said, you'd love it. So I went initially to get a job on the boat, wasn't accepted, got on another boat, did the first leg on one boat. And then when I got to Cape Town, the cook on the boat got off and they were suddenly looking for a cook. And there I was, just in the right place at the right time again. So, I mean, it was just such a great experience. I mean, it was hard because they didn't want a girl on the boat and they made that extremely clear. But, you know, it had never been done before. A girl had never raced on an ocean racing maxi in the Whitbread. So they were, you know, I guess understandably reluctant, didn't want to be some sort of social experiment. But, it, you know, in the end, by the time we got to the halfway stage, we'd won a leg and I became their lucky charm. And suddenly I ended up with 17 older brothers, which made dating very hard. You know, I learned so much. And I learned then that what I really loved was being out on the ocean. And that's what I wanted to do again, but maybe not with smelly boys, with girls this time.
Well, during that first race, was it difficult or hard to maybe thought of as a bit of a novelty in a sense?
It was, well, that's an interesting question. I've never been asked that before, and there's not many questions I've never been asked before. At first it was really hard because I felt very much like an outsider, and I'm not someone that takes being an outsider very well. It doesn't do my mental well-being any good. I like people. I like being around people. I could never do single-handed sailing. So I like to be involved within a team. So the first bit was very, very hard. And I nearly did get off at the next stopover. But I just something in me said, you've got to stick at this because you can change the way they view you. And I think when they realized I wasn't a liability and I wasn't going to fall over the side or do something stupid, they started to bring me into the fold. And then I think then being a novelty was then quite a good thing because I became the, you know, we'd go into port and they'd say, look, we've got a girl on the boat. Look, we're the only people with a girl on the boat, you know, and it was kind of a good thing in the end.
And then the idea to actually head your own team, which I think was currently from the 89 Whitebread, was that just born out of, I guess, the frustration of maybe how you were being treated as part of the man's team, and how easy was it for you to find that all-women's team to compete?
Well, it was born out of frustration, I think, really, because I hadn't minded too much being a cook on the boat. I mean, it's just the worst job, but it got me out there. And then I thought, wait a minute, if I'm going to always be a cook or a stewardess, maybe I have to change things. Maybe I'm not within the world that I need to be in. I need to change this world. So how do I do that? Okay, well, what about if we put an all-female crew together? With mixed reactions, actually, from my guys on the boat that I was on, they thought it was a great idea, and they said, look, if anyone can do it, you can. So I thought, well, if they think that, then fine. It was only when I announced it publicly that we had the sort of the incredibly negative, sort of attitude. And finding the girls was really hard because I was the only one out of maybe, I guess, 10 women that had raced around the world at that point, in the whole world. And I wasn't going to skip a maiden because I thought, well, I can't be a skipper. I've just only been a cook. I want to do the navigation and I'll find a skipper. But I couldn't. So that's how I ended up skippering maiden, just because I couldn't find anyone else to do it. But then I know, you know, we word of mouth went out, and suddenly from all over the world came these amazing women who quietly had all this amazing experience. And okay, they hadn't raced around the world, but they'd done everything else we needed. So we cobbled together this amazing team, and it really worked. It worked really well.
How prepared were you for the onslaught of reactions and skepticism that came your way? I mean, surely, having been in this world, you must have known some of it was coming your way. Were you prepared for how much of it was thrown at you?
No, not even close. Because in a way, I had never really had that kind of male chauvinism shoved down my throat, because I'd always been in my place, in the galley. So although I was on a male racing boat, I was still in the galley. So I'd never really come across that. It was only when I said, well, I'm going to skip this boat and it's going to be all female, that everyone just, I mean, God, you would have thought I'd said I was going to go out and, I don't know, take my clothes off and run down the street. I mean, it was just, everyone was just horrified. And then it was really, and this is really an interesting, I think, part of this whole process, because I didn't think of myself as a feminist then. I just thought, well, I just want to do this. I'm going to do it for myself and for other girls, maybe can get something out of it. And I was interviewed when I was very young at the beginning of the project, and someone said to me, are you a feminist? And I went, oh, no, absolutely not. That's a horrible word. You know, ah. But then towards the end, I'm thinking, I am a feminist. Absolutely. If feminism means equality, then can't sign me up. Absolutely. So I went through this sort of change. I think we all probably did. So in a way, I think these guys did us a favour, because they made it such a battle.
As you were going through the race, and you're receiving all this press coverage, how do you, I guess, mentally stay grounded through all that? Because you're dealing with all this, and you have this, and you're sailing around the world at the same time, and you're in charge of a bunch of people.
You harness it. And that's one of the most important lessons I think I've ever learned in my life. And it's not something I think you can be taught. You know, I do leadership programs and motivational talks and all these other things, but it's very hard to visualize, I think, and to understand that part of the process, but I think maybe we all go through this in our lives. We just don't give it a label. I think when we got to the end, I realized that what I've been doing was taking hold of that anger and keeping it, you know, learning where to keep it, which is not up here, it's here, so it's always there, and when you are a little bit behind, it's there reminding you, that boat in front of you, that's full of guys on it that think you're useless, so it gives you that little bit of energy and drive, and so it really became something that we used, and I think we all did. And the other thing I noticed, there are two things that I noticed about us as a crew, were we were very quiet. So on the start line, there'd be all these boats going around going, oh, starboard, get out of our way, pull that up, and you know, all this sort of stuff going on. And we'd be completely silent. So I remember getting to one of the stopovers and the guy saying, you're not talking to each other, you lot. And I went, yeah. He said, well, there's no shouting. I went, oh, we just don't like shouting at each other. And the other thing I think that we did through necessity probably was, I think the reason we had so few arguments on the boat was because we turned our any aggression or anger or frustration we had, we turned it outwards, away from us, and we came together to do that. So, I mean, all of these things ended up being very positive.
What was the feeling like for you when you actually won your first leg of the trip?
It was unbelievable. It's every person should have one moment in their life like this, just one. It was so much better than we thought it was going to be. I mean, you see, we had no doubts that we could win a few legs, and we had every intention of coming first. I mean, in the end, we didn't. We came second, but it surpassed every dream I'd ever had of winning any of the legs, and coming in over 24 hours ahead of our nearest rival, and just watching, you know, the collective sailing world jaws just literally dropped open. So unbelievably satisfying. It was amazing.
Did you find that that was the moment you maybe earned respect or a certain amount of respect from the male sailors, or did that make them maybe more angry?
Oh, they didn't like it very much. It's interesting, actually, because the guys that weren't in our class, they loved it. They thought it was highly entertaining. But for the poor guys who were in our class, I mean, it didn't go down well. sorry, excuse me. So I don't think we were quite within the, oh, they're competitive team yet. It was only when we won the third leg coming into New Zealand, which said we'd won a really hard, long, you know, sort of stamina leg, and then we'd won a short tactical leg as well. I think that's the point when people went, actually, they might be able to do quite well at this. Actually, that's the point we went, blimey, we could do quite well.
One aspect of the story that's always intrigued me is how you became friendly, I guess, with the King of Jordan. And I think that intrigues a lot of people just because there's a lot of misconceptions about their treatment of women in that part of the world. But how did that aspect of this whole journey come about? Where did that start?
Well, I was working on a charter boat in Newport, and King Hussein and Queen Noor were in America for the graduation of Prince Abdullah, who's now King Abdullah. And so they wanted to charter a boat for the day, relax. He had very little time off. I mean, I didn't actually know who they were because I was some ignorant 21-year-old that didn't read the news, and I didn't have a clue. But everyone else on the boat was going, oh my goodness, it's King Hussein of Jordan. I'm like, okay. So I think that meant that I treated him in a very normal way, and he really likes that about people, and I think that used to draw him to people. I mean, King Hussein was a collector of people. He loved human beings, and I think that's what made him such a great leader and Jordan such a stabilizing influence, of course, in the Middle East, which it still is today. That's all his influence and his incredible vision and love of mankind. And he was fascinated by my lifestyle, and he came to help me dry up the dishes when I was washing up, which was just, I said, you can't do that. And he said, I can, I'm king. I went, okay. So, sorry, excuse me. We were chatting away, and he said, I'm fascinated by your lifestyle. He said, you're like a Bedouin, you're like a nomad. I said, yeah, I guess that's what I am. So I told him that I was going to do the 85-86 race, and we realised we both had a passion for navigation and logistics and communication. I'm a bit sad like that. So we kept in touch, and we developed this incredible friendship. But it wasn't really until he died that I realised he had amazing friendships with many people around the world. You know, he sponsored the first woman to jump out of a hot air balloon on the edge of space in a hang glider over the Jordanian desert. He was a ham radio operator, so he used to speak to all these random people in garden sheds all around the world with their sort of ham radios. He was an extraordinary man, and his vision for Jordan was that women should drive, go to university, get an education, have jobs. His other vision was for religion that we should all be able to live together. And you, in a country like Jordan, very much like Lebanon, you've got a church next to a mosque, next to an Orthodox, next to a, you know, and all the different lifestyles all merge into one. I mean, it's a vision, if we could achieve it, for the whole world. But, you know, whether we will, I don't know. But he was amazing.
And isn't it true that his daughter is your sort of the new patron of, I guess, Maiden 2.0, right? Is that?
Yeah, so she heard that we were, I met her when she was 12 years old in Jordan, and she remembers Maiden really clearly. I mean, she remembers things I've forgotten about. Apparently, I had a meeting and an argument with her father about the colour of the boat. She remembers that. So she called me up one night. She found my name and number on a PR thing. And she just said, she said, oh, my name's Hiya. And I said, hello, Hiya. She said, yeah, my father sponsored you the first time round. And it was like, oh, my goodness. So she said, how can I help? She said, my father would, you know, not forgive me if I didn't help, you know, with Maiden the second time to rescue her and everything else. So through her very generous support, we were able to rescue Maiden and completely restore her. And that's down to Her Royal Highness Princess Hiya.
When you first found out, I think it was 2012 or something, 2013, when you heard about the Maiden's condition, how quick of a decision was it for you that I'm gonna take it back, in a way?
Instantaneous. It was, the timing was, you see, everything about this project has been about synchronicity and timing. It's like someone up there is, you know, I got the email and it said, your boat is rotting away in the Seychelles. We don't know what to do with her. And that day, I just thought, right, well, I finished one project. What am I going to do now? The email came through and I went, ah, that's what I'm going to do now. So I emailed them back and I went, please just keep hold of her and, you know, I'll raise the money. And they were great. You know, they sort of kind of maintained her, probably not as well as they might have. But anyway, they kept her and we raised the money through crowdfunding, of all things. And we bought her, it took 2 years, but we bought her in October 2016. But it was an instant decision. I couldn't let her die.
And then now you're the subject of a documentary about this whole thing. How receptive were you to being the subject of a big movie and getting your old crew back together and being interviewed and reliving all this again?
That's, again, a very interesting question. I guess, you know, I've had some real ups and downs in my life, and I've spent the last 13 years recovering from doing another thing in the Middle East for which we didn't get paid. And so I've had a few knocks and bruises. So when someone called me up out of the blue and said, I'm a film director and I want to make this documentary, I wasn't my usual kind of, oh, that sounds brilliant, optimistic self. I was a little bit more reticent. But as soon as I met Alex Holmes, who's the director, the way he talked about Maiden, I thought, this guy totally gets it. He gets Maiden and us. But the funny thing was, he said, well, I'm guessing because it's so long ago, there's no footage, so we'll make like a drama. And I went, oh no, we filmed everything. We've got hundreds of hours of stuff. And he was just like, what? So it was his dream to make a documentary, and we had all the footage. I mean, we had to find it all. It took them 2 years to find it all. It was everywhere. But I think I'm so glad I made the decision to do it, because one thing he said to me was, the time to make a really truthful and meaningful documentary is 30 years after something. He said, because you tend to tell the truth more, you've got no image from then that you need to protect, and you can be you, and you're old enough to be able to make decisions where, you know, people don't like what I'm saying, I don't really care that much, I'm going to tell the truth. So all of the girls, we've all stayed in touch over the years, and we all had a talk about it. And the real question for everyone was, how honest do we be? You know, how honest are we? So I said, I think we've got to really trust these guys. And I think whatever we say, I think we've got to be really truthful. And we all agreed. And I think that's one of the reasons people like this documentary so much. I think they've done such an amazing job. They drew stuff out of me that I was very surprised, that I remembered was even in there, and stuff that about myself, which I guess is quite critical of me as a person. And I found myself just spilling this stuff out. So he's a very good interviewer as well, Alex. And everyone, all the girls said the same. We didn't have editorial rights. He was very clear on that. So we really had to trust him. But he absolutely did not let us down. And I think he got what everyone loves is this raw sense of the truth, warts and all. Some of it's good, some of it's not good, but it's who we were.
You mentioned that, you know, obviously they also included footage of the other side, the people who didn't want you to do this and being critical. Was that difficult at all to relive? Were you okay that he included it to make it a more whole and complete story?
Well, we actually asked, because we're now all friends, you see, so after all that happened. I mean, Bob Fisher, you know, who said it, we were a tin full of tarts. I mean, we've been best mates ever since then, and he's hugely supportive of everything I've done since then. I mean, I think what was hard for them, and what I appreciate so much about what they did, is they had to tell the truth about what they were like then. And I think that must have been really hard, you know, to admit, this is what I said. And I mean, now Bob says, oh, I feel so, you know, ashamed. And we did say to them, please do tell the truth. Because that was then, and this is now. And I'm so glad that they did, because I think it really comes through what that image of the time was. You know, like, my daughter is 19 years old. And, you know, she says to me, Mum, I don't know what the fuss is about. Women can do anything. And I'm like, yeah, now. 30 years ago, it was so different. So I'm really glad that they had the courage to say what they said.
You know, on that note, you mentioned how you sort of became a feminist by the end of the journey. And I know that sort of in between your maiden stuff, you were doing a lot of motivational speaking and a lot of activism for girls in schools and stuff. How much of that part of your life do you think was just an extension of the beliefs and the lifestyle that you acquired post maiden?
I think I was probably born a feminist, but I just didn't know it. I've always been. Well, actually, okay, I have a very clear radar for what's right and what's wrong, and a clear sense of justice. And one of the things I cannot stand is any type of person being told that they're of a lower standard, that they can't do something, that they're not as important. And that is across the board for me. It just so happens I'm a woman, and it just so happens I lived in a time where I was told I couldn't do something because I was a woman. So I think obviously that's why I went down that route. But for me, activism and social justice and feminism and equality they're all the same thing, and we're all fighting the same battles. And I think, okay, fine, we pick our battles, but if we all pick something and change it, then we change the world. And I'm absolutely convinced, for me, girls' education is such a passion, because I am absolutely convinced that if every girl in the world had an education, we would be 99.9% of the way there to solving the world's problems. I really do think that, you know, and I watch in America at the moment and in Canada and in Europe, teenage girls marching to save the planet. And I'm just blown away by this. How amazing. I mean, at their age, I don't know anything about the planet or anything. I didn't care about anything except, you know, going out and having a good time. So I think educating girls for me has become this passion, because I see how it can change things.
Oh, I just wanted to, on that note, how much do you think activism itself has changed within the last 30 years, especially now in the technological and information age that we're in?
I think that's a real double-edged sword. I think, you know, I struggle with technology. I have had to learn as I've gone along. And I see that it has good things and bad things. You know, I see that it gives kids access to education in rural areas. I understand that, you know, social media in some ways is good, and that technology learning in school is a phenomenal tool. But I do think that social media has dragged girls back into a little bit of the dark ages, really, because I cannot believe when I see online, I mean, I very rarely have problems on social media. I'm quite benign online, which is not like me in real life. but I do see girls posting opinions on social media and having the most appalling, vile stuff said to them, threats and language that I just think, okay, so we're in the 21st century, a girl has expressed an opinion out loud and this is what she has to put up with. You know, there was a woman in the UK, I guess a couple of years ago, we lost Florence Nightingale off one of our banknotes, and it went back to all being all men on all the banknotes. And so this woman, Caroline de Crejo, she said, we got to have a woman on one of the banknotes, you know, come on. And she was subjected to the most horrifying campaign of trolling online anyone has ever seen. I mean, it was just awful. So I think there's such great things about technology and social media moving forwards. But I think if we continue to give children access to social media without teaching them respect and empathy and politeness and understanding that we all have different opinions, you know, that social media has become a bit of a knee-jerk shouting area, whereas in real life, of course, human beings are mostly not like that. So I don't know what the way through is on that, but we've got to make it a usable space for everyone.
You know, yes, you're involved with the restoration of Maiden too, but how involved would you say you still are in the overall world of competitive sailing?
Not really. I'm very critical of my industry. I'm very critical of women working, you know, the opportunities that women have within the industry, the way they're treated. I do maybe, I guess, well, I have a voice, and I'm old enough and ugly enough now that I don't need to make people like me, and I'm not within the sailing world, I'm not within the racing world, so I can be more outspoken. And I think what I'm quite happy doing is working with my generation of women who find we're all in this sort of same arena, where we're happy to speak out so that the younger girls and the younger women don't have to, because they're still in there, you know, they're still in that arena, and if they pipe up about stuff that's going on racing boats or whatever, they won't get another job. So I think that maybe that is my role now, to sort of be the annoying grumpy old woman from the sidelines.
You know, I saw something a few years ago how it said professional sports is the one area where something like don't ask, don't tell still is really, really entrenched. And I'm curious, do you find it's that the same way with sexism as well, that we're smashing a lot of these other, I guess, you know, gender norms and gender taboos, but within the world of all, not just sailing, but all professional sports, it's still a barrier that maybe we haven't quite cracked yet? And how do we go about breaking that?
I think you're absolutely right, but I don't think this is just about women. You know, in Britain, our first gay footballer came out years ago. I mean, I can't even remember how many years ago. But we still, gays, lesbians, we still have these problems. Now, you know, we're still having those problems. Women are having problems. There's so many issues to deal with, but I don't think you can target or identify one specific area. I think it goes back to this whole thing of teaching respect. And if we don't all start, you know, I look at stuff on Facebook and bits and pieces, and I saw something the other day in a school they've started meditation instead of, what do they call it, after they keep them home from school, so they've started meditation instead of punishment. And the behaviour within the school has changed beyond recognition. So I think it's about sports at the grassroots level, and I think my sports, well, maybe it is getting better, but it's a long way to go. teaching respect for other human beings at grassroots level. And I think that goes across the board. And why aren't we doing that? I still find it amazing that people are pilloried for being a different colour, a different religion, for being gay, for being female, for being disabled. It does my head in. So for me, that is it, teaching respect for other people.
And yet, I don't know anything about sailing, but the most famous sailing story I remember of the last few years is this teenage girl who sailed around the world. I think she was 16 and was was Dutch. As someone who is both an activist and a former sailor, what was it like hearing a story like that?
I think she was too young. I'm going to be a bit controversial. I thought she was way too young. I thought it was an incredible worry. She didn't have the life experience. You know, she was a great sailor and she was fit and strong, but nothing prepares you for what can happen out in the ocean. So I thought she was too young. But then on the other hand, you know, there's a 16-year-old Australian, Jade, I can't remember her surname, Haymaster, who's just walked to the South Pole. So I guess with the right support and the right, the right support system around them, then yes, they can do it. I wouldn't let my daughter go around the world at 16. But, you know, each to their own. I'm no one to judge. I think it's extraordinary when young people go out and do amazing things. And want inspiration.
And yet, it seemed strange because I don't know if perhaps the conversation that was had or even it would have received that much coverage had she been a 16-year-old boy.
I think it would have been the same.
Yeah?
In this one case, I think age was the common denominator that made people go, oh, 16, that's incredibly young. You know, you haven't finished developing your brain until you're 21 years old. You know, you're not fully, you know, frontal lobe is not fully developed. Understanding consequences of your actions, the immediate thought processes that go along with dealing with an emergency, none of those are developed yet. So in men or women, so I thought that was, I didn't think that was really a distinction between girls and boys.
When I looked you up online, the first thing it says about you is former competitive sailor. And then, you know, like you're from Wikipedia, and then it says also, you know, activist for, you know, and public speaker and all this. Are you okay with that being what you're known for and sort of that being the first thing you're listed as?
I don't really care about labels, so, I mean, I've been called worse in my life. that bloody woman, you know, amongst other things. I think that... you know, when I first started sailing, I was called diminutive former ballerina. So, you know, I guess ex-sailor is a step up. I don't know why we all have to have labels, but I have no problem with it at all.
You know, my late uncle was a lighthouse keeper and a man of the sea, and my family, I don't think, really understood it until very, very recently. But just in terms of being out there on the water, surrounded by wilderness, surrounded by oceans, surrounded by the earth that we live in, how does that impact a person? What is the feeling emotionally of just sitting in and living in that environment?
The ocean kind of connects you to everything. Not just physically, emotionally, spiritually, no matter what you believe in or don't believe in, it's impossible not to have some connection with the universe, with nature, with some sort of sense of spirituality when you're out there. And it feels like being connected to everything. It is a complete sense of freedom, I mean, apart from now the fact that all the pollution you now see in the sea, which I, in just my 40 years of ocean sailing, I've noticed the difference in the weather, the trade winds, the pollution, the plastic, the diminishing sea life. That's just in 40 years that we've managed to do that. Apart from that, which you are also connected to, and you do come back and think, oh, I've got to do something about this. I've got to change my ways. I've got to get other people to change their ways. So there's that. But there's also this sense that you are seeing what the first person who crossed an ocean, you're seeing exactly what they saw, if you can't see land, or even if you can see land and it hasn't changed. And that's phenomenal. And they say, you know, the ocean, well, the ocean used to be like the desert. We don't leave a mark. I mean, now mankind is destroying it along with everything else. But, you know, you pass through the ocean. The ocean doesn't remember you, doesn't care. Yeah. It's like the desert, your footsteps disappear. You're so minuscule. It's a real eye-opener.
You know, you mentioned the pollution, and pollution and climate change and the environment, that's really become the issue for activists of this generation. And we talk about climate marches. How much of that was discussed, you know, when you were sailing back in the 80s? And do you find that it's discussed now at all in the boating community?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, in the 80s, we didn't even think about it. I mean, we didn't even notice what, you know, I mean, just extraordinary. We had no concept. Whereas now, oh, my goodness, yes. You know, you've got Dee Kafari with the Turn the Tide on Plastic in the Volvo. You've got, I mean, definitely within the sailing community now, there's a massive activist sentiment, really, that we all now not just have to play our part, but we really have to change the whole world. And again, going back to girls' education, for me, you see, you look at a lot of these ecological and planet-saving and diversity charities and you know, social enterprises and all these organisations. A lot of them are led by women. We're very good at doing this. You know, we are nurturers by nature. And I think this whole girls' education thing, angling that towards the future of the planet, you know, there's a real connect there. And I think the two things go alongside each other. But obviously all of us have to work together. I mean, it's an unimaginable disgrace what we have done to this planet and what we are continuing to do. There's an advert on Sky News which does ocean rescue plastic cleanup at the moment. And it basically says, from Greenpeace, and it says, we are the first generation that realises we're destroying the planet and the last generation that may be able to do anything about it. And that, to me, is, whoa, there's no more wiggle room. There's no more, we'll get round to that, we'll sort that out, you know. So, yeah, we're you know. So climate deniers are my least favourite people in the whole world. And, you know, this whole sort of greed and drive to money and, you know, the ever-present profit of everything, valuing nothing, you know, I think people are waking up to it. People have had enough. Let's hope it's not too late.
You know, given that you have been such an inspiration and a role model for, you know, teens, women, girls, is there anybody in your life that you consider a role model that you would still like to meet?
Oh my God, that's such a good question. Oh my goodness, Michelle Obama. I think it is definitely up there on my list. But there are so many inspirational people in the world right now. Do you know that saying, you know, that when the world needs the right people, they come along, we just have to recognise them? I think, unfortunately, at the top of a lot of countries at the moment, we don't have the right people. Let's not go any further there. But there are great people out there. So I think it's recognising those and supporting them and being inspired by them. And they are there. Maybe just not at the sidelines. Maybe not at the top. They're maybe around the sidelines, and we have to seek them out and empower them.
You know, but I do think Britain has one of the greatest environmentalists in the public eye, Sir Attenborough. Have you met Sir Attenborough?
Once, yes, and I nearly curtsied. I mean, I nearly dropped to my knees. The man is an absolute legend. What he did with the programs, the Blue Planet, is unimaginable. He woke people up. You know, they were, and I don't know about you, but I find it sometimes quite difficult to watch things that show animals in distress or our planet being destroyed. But he made these programs so cleverly that before you realised what you were watching, you were so engrossed that you couldn't turn away. And I mean, he is just he's just an absolute legend.
What advice would you give to young people today?
Oh my God, fight, stand up, fight, scream, shout, don't leave it up to other people, don't leave it up to our generation, we've mucked everything up. Young people, you've got to clear up the mess that we made and you've got to make us do it. And that's why I love these marches so much. You know, and this is something else I don't understand. In the UK, we've just had children going on strike from school and demonstrating for a day. And they are being trolled by grown-up people. What is that? I'm in so in awe of these young people. And adults are telling them to stop being so stupid and go back to school. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So what I would say to young people is don't shut up. Keep going. Keep shouting. Keep fighting. Stand up. Be counted.
Well, the documentary is Maiden. I think it's out in the UK now and comes out in North America in a couple of months?
I think it's out at the end of April.
Okay.
Yes.
Tracy Edwards, it's been a delight talking with you today. Thank you so much.
So nice to talk to you, Dom.
Cheers. That was my conversation with former sailor, public speaker, and activist Tracy Edwards. She is the subject of a new documentary, Maiden, which will be released at the end of April. That does it for me today. My immense thanks to Tracy Edwards for the interview today. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.